The Church of Holy Trinity in Invercargill is a modern structure with a piece of religious iconography behind the altar whose theme I wish many other churches had copied. It depicts Christ on the cross, but in a victorious mode, wearing the Eucharistic vestments of a priest and with a crown on his head. This is what is called a Christus Victor kind of religious image that combines the themes of a sacrificial death on the cross together with his glorious resurrection. Obviously, this is an image rich in theological depth, some of which I intend to explore a little later on. But for now, I want to comment on the ability of Anglican laity to sometimes trivialise and reduce to the level of banality such profundity. The statue is Christ wearing kingly slippers that unfortunately the artist painted green. So it has come to pass that the Christus Victor statue is popularly known by Invercargill Anglicans as Jesus with the green socks, a moniker that has proved impossible to shake. Here, of course, one thinks of Father Carl's slippers that he always celebrated Mass in, companion pieces to his famous dressing gown with teddy bears on it that he was in the habit of wearing when he greeted parishioners at the door of the vicarage. I sometimes think that the teddy bear dressing gown and the accompanying slippers should be reverently placed on the coffin prior to his funeral. Back to the Christus Victor iconography now at Holy Trinity in Invercargill. It has Christ's arms flung out wide in the orans, or prayer position as it's called, the stance that a priest takes when reciting the great Thanksgiving prayer, otherwise known as the prayer of consecration, over the bread and wine at the altar. This is an image of Christ, our great high priest. Incidentally, the first Mass I celebrated after my ordination to the priesthood was a votive Mass of Christ, our great high priest. When we look at an image of Christ on the cross, we're seeing the complete offering of himself that he made to the Father. He goes to the cross impelled by the Father's initiative. It isn't an accidental event that spins off from his preaching tour of Jerusalem. As he is nailed to the cross, Christ makes of this tragic death an offering of himself to the Father. Into your hands I commend my spirit. This movement of offering from the Son to the Father is something that continues beyond the crucifixion and the resurrection, and is in fact a perpetual and eternal movement of self-giving love within the life of the Trinity. This is the rhythm of the internal life of God. The Son gives himself to the Father, and the Father returns that love, much enriched in a shower of blessings. Each time the Eucharist is celebrated, we are given an opportunity to share in that circulating rhythm of love within the Trinity. I love the way Rowan Williams puts it. The glorified Christ, crucified and risen, is eternally active towards the Father on our behalf, drawing us into the eternal movement of self-giving love that the Son directs towards the God Jesus calls Abba. In the Eucharist, our prayer is swept up into that current, and we are set free to share in the Son's self-giving. When we kneel at the altar rails, the gift we receive is the life of the Son, the return gift from the Father, who has accepted the self-offering of his Son, and who has further enriched it as he sends it down to us to enter our lives and to knit us into the pattern of his Son's life. Jesus with the green socks behind the altar at Holy Trinity is a striking visual reminder of those words from John's Gospel we heard this morning. Unless a wheat grain falls on the ground and dies, it remains only a single grain, but if it dies, it yields a rich harvest. The bread of heaven that we shall feed on this morning is a costly gift of himself from Christ, our great high priest, that has come to us via his most generous Father. However, it's a crucial event prior to the crucifixion that I want to focus on this morning. I'm referring to what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane and the famous prayer that Jesus offered up then. This is what Hebrews was driving at this morning in those opening words. During his life on earth, Christ offered up prayer and entreaty, aloud and in silent tears, to the one who had the power to save him out of death, and he submitted so humbly that his prayer was heard. Was his prayer heard? On the face of it, what he asked for urgently he did not receive. Let's recall the prayer itself. Father, O my Father, all things are possible to you. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Maybe Jesus knows that he goes to his death by the foreknowledge and direct intention of his Father. Maybe he has foreseen that his ministry can have only this outcome. But now that he's just hours away from this terrible fate, he shrinks from it. He is horrified at the prospect of it, and he presents his distress to the Father in an emotional and dramatic way. There's no stiffer upper lip here, no stoical, ironically understated, dignified acceptance of the inevitable here. It's a Mediterranean, over-the-top, high affectivity style of response. It also provides commentary on and a plea based on the miraculous works of power that have been worked through him with powers originating from his Father. Given all that, he asks, is there a possible or better way through this terrible situation in which there appear to be no good choices? The dilemma that Jesus faces is closely aligned with the loaded question as to why God permits evil and suffering to exist in the world. That in turn raises the issue as to what God is up to in organizing the way the world is. The truth is that God is trying to bring the world back to himself from its lost state, and he's not just trying to make us happy, in other words, to provide us with narcotics. In order to bring the world back to himself, he must try to solve the underlying issues that brought about the state of estrangement from himself and that blocked the path to true human flourishing. He must, along the way, accept this as a given that human freedom is an instrumental good that is essential for love to exist. He must accept the human capacity to choose good and bad, to choose for God and against God's self. Freedom, then, entails the likelihood of sin and rejection. Gethsemane then shows that God cannot do some things without the occurrence of evil and suffering. Furthermore, God cannot do what is contrary to the nature of things, to the way in which the world has been built. He also cannot do things that contradict his own nature. Nor will God do what is contrary to his previous promises and plans. This is why Jesus concludes his Gethsemane prayer with an act of radical obedience to the Father's will and to the plot lines of his mission and ministry. He accepts the limitations I've just mentioned that are inescapably linked with this world of freedom and tragic suffering. By this act of radical obedience, he shows himself to be the second Adam, the model man, the shining exemplar of the new humanity who defines what a human being should be. The Gethsemane prayer is the most powerful prayer that's ever been uttered. It has been said that reality begins to rearrange itself around it from that point on. From that point on, nothing can ever be the same again. It sets the scene and establishes the tone for all that will follow in the events of Holy Week. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.